On behalf of the World Affairs Council and the Microfinance CEO Working Group, it's my pleasure to moderate this evening. My name is Maya Koringel, and I would like to first introduce our esteemed guests. Just a small note that the working group represents several hundred microfinance organizations around the world, serving several million, multiple million people. It is a great pleasure for the city of San Francisco to host them at one of their meetings, and it's a great honor to have them here tonight. Alex Counts, who is sitting next to me, founded the Grameen Foundation and became its CEO and president in 1997. Before leading the Grameen Foundation, he served as the legislative director for results and as a regional project manager for CARE Bangladesh. Mary Ellen Iskandarian is president and CEO of Women's World Banking. Previously, for 17 years, although she's not that old, she was at the International Finance Corporation, which is a private sector arm of the World Bank. And Steve Hollingworth has served as the president of Freedom from Hunger, which is here locally in the Bay Area, since September of 2011. And prior to joining Freedom from Hunger, he spent 26 years with CARE and has held multiple senior field positions throughout the world in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I would also like to welcome the following executives from the Microfinance CEO Working Group who are in our audience this evening, and perhaps you can wave so the folks here will know who you are. And they may join our conversation during the Q&A session. We have Scott Brown of Vision Fund International, Rosario Perez of ProMujer, we have Rupert Schofield of Finca International, is David here?
No, he's not.
No, and...
Michael's not.
Okay. Full biographies for all of our speakers and all of the participants are available in your program and also on the World Affairs Council website. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the panelists for this evening for a conversation about how microfinance organizations combine small loans together with a multiplicity of services to help alleviate poverty around the world. Thank you for coming. I'd like to begin the conversation this evening by asking Alex and Mary Ellen to comment a little bit about what the priorities of the working group, of the CEO working group are. Many in the audience, I'm sure, and who are listening to us are familiar with microfinance. It has evolved over the years. Microfinance has been in existence for centuries, but more sort of in its current form for the last four decades. It's been a little bit more in the zeitgeist over the past 10 years, with some controversy, with much positive results. A lot of conversation about what is going on in the industry. And if you can tell us about what you CEOs are thinking about and concerned about.
Okay. Well, I think, as in order to give some background, somewhere I would say about 5 to 8 years ago, it kind of came upon us that had been involved in microfinance, especially those of us for a long time, that a lot of the things that we had set out to do, whether we started in the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s, we had reached, if not exceeded, the things we'd been dreaming about credit in particular becoming much more available to the world's poor and especially women. But at that point, I think the challenges and opportunities before our field fundamentally transformed. When you reach those first set of milestones that you've been working at for, in some cases, years or decades. And those challenges and those opportunities, I think we all came to feel were best confronted collectively in a collaborative way rather than individually. Mary Ellen, organizations that have a particular focus on the gender dimension of microfinance have tended to gravitate and be members of Women's World Banking. We all have relationships with organizations that share our particular focus, but there's a larger industry agenda that I think we had sometime neglected. When we came together 5 years ago to confront this second generation of opportunities and challenges, I think I put them basically in three categories. First of all is uniform standard setting for our field. We'd all kind of had somewhat disparate standards. No one really knew what was the ultimate standard. And I'd say they were in two basic categories: standards for client protection, so that we can be sure that an organization, if they meet these standards, that they're doing just about everything that they can do to make sure that their clients aren't being harmed by the products that they're delivering. And also standards for what I'll call client advancement, or what in our field we call social performance, to get behind and to drive a uniform idea of what that meant. And so it would create clarity throughout the industry. And so we've been focused on those from about our inception. Industry initiatives that we're moving for but kind of lagging, that we've tried to put some energy behind. Secondly, it was around a focus on our microfinance have been so focused on what I'll call outputs, loans or accounts opened. And we want to drive an industry conversation about getting more standard and rigorous about outcomes and impact. And so that's a second focus. And the third is a little bit more nebulous, I suppose, but actually about developing a real trusting relationships among those of us in this working group, so that we have those basis of relationships to confront the challenges and opportunities that we don't even have in front of us yet, but we will. Because to do this together rather than individually, we feel is that really the opportunity we have now in the moment we're in.
Thank you, Alex.
I actually don't have a whole lot to add to that. It was beautiful, Alex. I guess the only thing I would say is I would absolutely reinforce what Alex said about the group coming together. I think up until that first meeting, we really saw each other, maybe not as competitors, but at least we were all sort of vying for the same donor funding and sort of all going after very similar pieces of a perhaps too small pie. And by coming together, it's been really, really wonderful to build this much more collegial, much more mature industry, really. And I guess the only other piece that I would add is I certainly know at Women's World Banking, we just have been so frustrated with really the naming of this industry. We moved, we feel, very successfully from calling it microcredit to microfinance, and we all meant, those of us in the industry, savings, insurance, financial education, pensions, all of the same financial products that you and I need and want and have access to, but somehow the popular imagination never really caught up with that. And I think there's still, when you say microfinance, there's still a preponderance of thinking about credit. And so I think those of us in the room were really eager to get the word out on the much more varied work that we were doing, the much broader based set of products that were being offered, the way they were being delivered, that we just didn't really feel like the popular imagination or the popular press as well was really picking up.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. There are several themes that came up in your description, which we will talk about, and I'd love to ask some questions. And one of the points, and Steve, perhaps if you can address this point, there has been some criticism in the microfinance and microcredit industry that there isn't enough attention paid to the poor and the positive impact that provision of financial services can have on the lives of the poor. And I was wondering whether you could speak a little bit to that point and what programs are in place, whether at Freedom from Hunger or in the industry at large, to increase the impact and ensure that the impact on poor members of the community is being felt.
Thanks, Maya. That is the nub of the issue, really, I think, for the core mission of microfinance. If you go back to our origins, microfinance really was begun on the promise that it would be a contributing factor to addressing poverty globally. And if you look at most recent figures from the Microcredit Summit campaign reporting, the proportion of the global clientele accessing microfinance, for very poor clients has actually declined. And that's worrisome, right? I think there's a risk that microfinance, because it's profitable in certain markets and because there's an established successful client base in certain markets, that we're not working hard enough to go to pioneering areas in terms of regions or product development that really do address the 850 million people who are chronically hungry. That's the focus of Freedom from Hunger, is trying to do that. And so I think there is an unfulfilled promise. you know, microfinance is key. It's a very important ingredient at a macro level in a country. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that with expansion of financial services, it actually improves the income distribution levels, that by opening up financial access to poorer sections of the population, you create more inclusive growth. That's a conclusion that is hard and understood well. Credit on its own is a major contributor to business development. We see that. It's less of a contributor to things like household income or household consumption. Certainly group-based microcredit, where we focus at Freedom from Hunger, that has major contributions to social dynamics, to opening up choice for women in particular, for offering a greater range of services that can be delivered through the group. So there are real important social dimensions that microfinance can contribute. So, you know, in our view, microfinance does need to continue to pioneer and reinvent and think of how business models address the needs of the poor. Savings is a major part of that. It's become a huge focus for all of us. You know, we believe also access to health care and health financing is another critical area that can include very, very poor clients. Loans are useful in certain circumstances, and they have certain impacts in certain ways. But there really is an array now of products, of development services, of channels that are now opening up, mobile money in particular, that really can meet this challenge of financial inclusion for very poor clients.
Thank you. One of the elements that has really developed or progressed in the last few years is a better understanding of the habits of the poor and really implementing behavioral economics into the crafting of financial products and different instruments that will benefit the poor. The Grameen Foundation has had significant experience in promoting micro savings and working with the Gates Foundation support to craft different kinds of financial products for the poor. And Alex, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of that work.
Sure. Well, from the very earliest days of Grameen, and by that I mean Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, compulsory and voluntary savings were a part of it from day one. But it's true that when we looked around and people had kind of taken that idea to other geographies, other parts of the world, it was often easier to get going quickly, and often in case the only thing you could do legally was to go with credit only. So there became a lot of organizations around the world that were, while perhaps having in the back of their mind the desire to go with a full set of financial products, credit, savings, and insurance, not to mention other non-financial products that Freedom from Hunger and ProMohair have been leading on. But many of them, it was just the credit became the sole focus. So drawing from, particularly when Grameen Bank reinvented its whole methodology in 2002 and came out with Grameen 2, that was a much more robust in terms of savings, where suddenly Grameen Bank had tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars more in savings than they had in loans, and had to figure out where to put that money. We got some funding from the Gates Foundation, as others did, to take some of these credit-dominated organizations and bring in savings. And we helped three organizations, and one in India, Ethiopia, and the Philippines, to basically add a million savers over the course of 4 years. Which we learned an awful lot, and they learned an awful lot. And if I had to, and again, for those of you who don't think about this every day, certainly the impact of credit is clear. You get some money, you invest it in a small business or something else that's going to generate income. That gets you in the path to leading a poverty-free life if your investment goes well. But savings, that ability to aggregate money for a rainy day, for a child's education, or to frankly keep it away from your spouse, this can be enormously important in being able to stabilize above the poverty line. So what did we learn? We rolled out some credit savings products in the Philippines with our partner Card, who also works with Women's World Banking, and also perhaps with Freedom from Hunger. We don't believe in monogamy, obviously. And the credit products were being taken up okay, pretty well, better than others in the market, but we weren't satisfied. So we brought in some people with expertise in behavioral economics. And I'll tell you a couple of things. There have been papers written about this you can look at. But one is, if you just actually have a form and a process of signing someone up that's simple enough but focuses on a couple things. Number one is have the person, when they're opening the account, think about what the goal, what their savings for, and articulate it in a form or to another human being. It seems to make a big difference. They kind of a vision, because money to be spent for a poor person, there's always something to spend it on. So you need to create a kind of that mental process that'll have someone stop and say, I want to actually save this instead of spend it. Now, if you actually give them some tool, very, very simple tools to plan, well, how are you going to reach that goal? Give them a calendar, a simple calendar of which they can kind of outline what those are. If you can, one of the simple things is in the Philippines, they give a small gift to the person on the opening an account, which in the spirit of reciprocity in the Philippines, well, I've made this commitment now, you've given me a gift, I really need to follow through. And something as simple as you sign this form that you're going to try to reach this goal, not legally enforceable, the bank signs it, a carbon copy is given to the person. Again, it's just them memorializing in a way that kind of gets imprinted on their psyche that they really want to reach this savings goal. And where we did that and compared it to people in a randomized test who didn't go through this process of goal setting, developing a simple plan, making a commitment on paper and or to another person, a representative of the bank, the amount of use of the savings account and the amount saved, all of which were dramatically different. So it's not simply a matter of giving people an opportunity to save, but not simply educating them and telling them they should do this, but designing a process that will kind of trigger their long-term desire to save so that it can more often than not overcome that desire to spend and consume and to meet the immediate needs.
Thank you. One of the other comments that Steve alluded to, and I'd ask Mary Ellen to comment on this, is the use of technology, especially the proliferation of mobile phones throughout the developing world. If you can talk a little bit about some of the innovation, Alex talked about innovation in design of product. How about innovation in terms of technology, mobile phones, et cetera, to increase the outreach of financial inclusion?
Well, just to follow on what Alex was saying, we at Women's World Banking, as our name might imply, really do have quite a focus on making sure that women have access to financial products and services. And that's really where savings makes such a difference. Women tend to be the savers in a household. And when we talk to women about what they want in products, they are universally, and actually this is both developed and developing countries, very, very clear about three things. They really, particularly with asset-building products like savings, they really want confidentiality. As Alex alluded, they really don't want their husbands, their sons, their other family members, their neighbors to know that they are saving or what they are saving for. They want convenience. Now, men want convenience too, but it's a real must-have for women. Women are time-starved. And if the bank or the product doesn't come to them, they're just not going to have the time to take it up. And there's some really fascinating studies. There's a great financial diary project from Malawi from a few years ago that showed that men were willing to pay up to $7 in transportation to go into the town to make a deposit, even if the van that was going to be coming around with the mobile ATM was going to come like the next day, even if they were going to deposit far less than $7 into the bank in the first place. Whereas the women uniformly said, I can wait till Tuesday when the van is going to come and I'll deposit. And then the third thing is security, both in the sense of the security and trust that they have with the organization and that their money is safe in that organization, as well as their own physical security. Carrying around a lot of cash is dangerous for both men and women, but is particularly dangerous for women. So when you put those three factors together, technology is a total win-win for all of those product features. And so where our work in savings has been very engaged in trying to make products that meet those three criteria, And I'll add to this is one thing that I think we're all so excited about the technological aspects. Kenya went from one of the lowest rates of financial inclusion certainly in sub-Saharan Africa in the world, I think about 19%. 7 years later, they're close to 40%, really just by the introduction of huge penetration in their economy of mobile money. But what we are consistently hearing from women, and again, it's very similar to what Alex was saying about the gifts in the Philippines, is a project, for example, that we're working on in Nigeria, where we developed a mobile-based and agent banking, so you can conduct banking at point-of-sale terminals and mom-and-pop shops. People really like the technology. Women love that convenience. They love that confidentiality. They have a SIM card or a four-digit PIN that their husband doesn't know anything about, and they can really protect themselves. But they are telling us, don't take away that human person that has been coming around and making sure that we have a little bit of financial education, that we are keeping to those goals that we've set. We feel an obligation to this individual who's the representative of the bank. And that's part of the reason why we're achieving our goals in the first place. So I think it opens up a really interesting question of, like, what's the balance between human interaction and technology, and what amount of human interaction really sort of turbocharges the possibilities of technology?
Sure. Now that's an important point. Thank you, Mary Ellen. Steve, if I can turn to you to talk a little bit perhaps about whether regional differences between what the circumstances are in Asia versus Latin America versus Africa, how those environments may impact the strategies employed. Does technology implementation happen better in one part of the world or the other, or just how do you think
right.
about that?
That's a broad palette, but yeah. I'll do my best. Right? I think, of course, really the areas of the world that are really confronting chronic malnutrition and hunger are basically South Asia and Africa, right? And there's a big difference in those contexts, right? In Africa in particular, you know, the microfinance sector is relatively immature, right? And mobile technology, mobile money is leapfrogging over it, right? And I think there's a lot of great work going on, in particular with the savings group movement. There's now 10.2 million women in sub-Saharan Africa who through groups have access to safe savings, promoting savings within their groups. Increasingly, you know, the banking sector and the mobile money sector is paying attention to this. And, you know, we're involved in structuring savings products for groups, for example, in Burkina Faso and Benin that are mobile money products, right? But that's a dynamic there. Essentially, how do financial services help, you know, chronically hungry people protect themselves in the lean season? Right, to smooth their income. I think that's the significance of savings for people who are food insecure, the 850 million people, as I mentioned, in that way. India as well has a very vibrant self-help group movement that does similar kinds of work, promoting savings, promoting social services, you know, the better distribution and reception of government programs coming into communities. So the link between development and finance in those areas are really critical, right? And, you know, the power of grassroots mobilization to do that is important. Now, globally, what's happening, I think, is that you've seen a very robust growth in microfinance, you know, before the Andhra Pradesh meltdown, and now even after it, you know, we're seeing still growth rates of 15% or greater annually. You know, this is a major industry now. 220 million clients, 90 billion in lending. So there's a huge robustness within microfinance, right? But I think what's happening, particularly in Latin America and in Asia, related to the microfinance sector, is they're having to compete with commercial providers coming down market, with mobile money coming down market, right? And I think they're going to have to begin competing on client loyalty, right? And that's going to mean knowing their clients very well, right? Knowing their patterns behaviorally, how they can support them to save better, knowing their needs from the point of view of health or housing, right, and offering a broader range of services, because if they're only competing on a price point with mobile money, they're in trouble. Now, many MFIs are also thinking about how they become actors in mobile money, right? And I think, you know, the related issue globally in all of what's going on with technology is that, you know, I'd like to really advocate very strongly that the mobile money sector doesn't make the mistakes maybe that microfinance did, right? You know, let's educate clients early, right? So let's pay attention to, you know, to their knowledge about financial products. Let's be responsible about that. Let's pay attention to the social impact, positive or negative, that we're seeing from this, right? But, you know, I think, again, globally, there's still a huge need for development services and financial services in Latin America and in Asia and Africa. There's a very different competitive environment emerging in Asia and in Latin America that microfinance is, I think, really going to have to pay attention to.
Great, thank you. I'll ask one question and actually start incorporating some of the audience questions into the conversation. But what we've talked mostly about financial services, savings products, a little bit about how mobile works into this. There are other services or products that could be theoretically offered through microfinance. Alex, I'd like perhaps for you to talk about how the Grameen Foundation and how microfinance can be used to promote healthcare. And I think the audience question that I'd like to weave into that is, how does the microfinance institution infrastructure position it to provide other kinds of services? Can it be done? Is it not possible? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'll kick it off here. You know, we're having this conversation that in fact, the title of this event is Beyond Loans. But I also don't want us in this way that in both the humanitarian sector and the social sector, we tend to kind of follow fads, and what was popular 5 or 10 years ago is now the thing you don't want to do. Credit can be enormously important. In fact, the interest and fees that the clients of microfinance pay on credit actually pays for an infrastructure that can be used to deliver a lot of other services, including savings, insurance, health related. And that's the point. Without, if you take credit out of it, it becomes a lot more difficult to actually to underwrite the infrastructure that can do other things. Now, many studies, one that I was a small part of 20 years ago, found that the single biggest reason that microfinance clients fail to thrive is because of a health crisis in the family. And so, in fact, it was bigger than all other reasons put together in one study in Bangladesh. So not surprisingly, just about each of our microfinance CEO network organizations are doing something in the area of healthcare, of how do we leverage what we've learned through scaling microfinance and the infrastructure we've developed in the process to address the healthcare needs of the poor. In Grameen Foundation's case, we did some things with the support from the Gates Foundation initially in Ghana, where number one, we felt there was a real opportunity, again, going back to this behavioral economics thing, to simply to send messages, reminders to pregnant women about good motherhood practices on a weekly basis, either through most of them prefer to get a voicemail, voice message, some prefer to get a text message. And just in that way, reinforcing whether it was a time to go in for a checkup or reminding them that eating this kind of food is good and that kind of food is not. Now, the study of the impact of that on anecdotally, we're very encouraged. There's a study going on which will tell us how much that moved the dial. And so that was one. And the other area that we kind of piggybacked, which worked well on that, is with all the work that we did in automation in microfinance to get people from taking these, you know, long ledgers, handwritten ledgers to track loans, which a lot of us have seen going back certainly to the 90s, we said we can leverage our knowledge of that to have the Ghana Health Service transform their information gathering from analog, from paper to digital, which would then allow for much better a database from which to send these reminder and messages and behavior change modification messages. So we had some real success with that, and we've used that and the technology we put to make that a really robust system to India. We're partnering with World Vision in 8 countries in Africa and taking that elsewhere. But again, it comes from what we learned, both what we learned in microfinance, which is the health is the single biggest reason people fail to thrive, and also figure how do we leverage what we've learned and the infrastructure we developed to then move the dial on health, because we have some, you know, potential to do that that not a lot of networks and social innovations have based on the relationships we have and the physical infrastructure throughout the third world.
I just wanted to add, I think what Alex just said and the role of particularly health insurance kind of bridges Steve's points and Alex's as a huge competitive advantage that microfinance institutions can have with their clients. We have a successful beyond our wildest dreams healthcare product that we piloted in Jordan with our microfinance partner, their Microfund for Women. And it's we have made it a compulsory product, so all borrowers have to have the product, largely because we wanted to build as big a risk pool as we possibly could, as quickly as we could. We now, 2.5 years into the delivery of the product, regularly have women coming into the branch saying, I'll take the loan if I have to, but I really want that insurance product. We're seeing tremendous anecdotal evidence of health outcomes that that we're hoping to get some funding to do a little bit more rigorous research on. But the product essentially for a monthly premium that is a fraction of what the women were telling us they were saving for precisely the health emergencies that Alex mentioned that can threaten everything that a family has worked for. So for a fraction of that cost, they get a daily per diem up to 40 days. It's equivalent to roughly whatever the day's wage would have been, upon proof of a hospital stay, including a hospital stay that is for maternal health care. And so we're starting to see anecdotal evidence of greater increase in attended births and just better health outcomes, people having the wherewithal, the cash, to go to the hospital. And we're now expanding in 6 other countries. In some countries, the state health offering isn't terrible, but the roads are, and the transportation costs to the hospital are so great that they still can't avail themselves of them. So this cash can be used for any of those purposes. I just one other thing. It's really good business for the microfinance institution as well. In Jordan, this very successful organization, 77% client retention rate before offering this product, which is really 3/4 of the clients are with them 5 years after they've walked through the door. Today, with that product, that number is 90%. So it's been a real way to hold on to clients that gets to the point that Steve made. And one last thing about it is we found that the pairing of a loan with either a health insurance product or a savings product could improve the repayment performance of that loan by up to 300 basis points, because you weren't forcing a family to make a choice, this month I'll pay the doctor or this month I'll pay my loan back. So we've become really evangelical about the value of dealing with those health crises through insurance.
Thank you. If I can start to incorporate some of the other members of the working group, I see Michael Schlein from Axion here. Michael, if you could come up to the podium here and answer a question from the audience. The question is, what role do commercial banks play in the world of microfinance, and how do you manage the involvement of commercial banks in the effort to fight poverty, to develop and grow poor communities, especially when commercial banks have an incentive to increase their own profits, possibly push up interest rates. Axion has had a lot of history working with commercial banks to bring them down to the communities that microfinance institutions serve. Perhaps you can comment on that.
First of all, delighted to be here, and so thank you. It's a great question, and it's actually evolved over many years. And Axion now works all over the world, but for most of our history, we grew up in Latin America. And you could see commercial banks being interested in serving the poor, but basically retreating when they realized it's enormously labor-intensive and costly. So for a while, you saw banks acquiring microfinance institutions and then sort of backing out saying, oh, we don't really want to be in this business. They've gotten a lot smarter more recently, and instead of trying to merge a microfinance institution into a bank culture, which has failed repeatedly, they now acquire microfinance institutions but keep them separate, which is much, much smarter. I have a bit of a theory on this, which is fundamentally at the base of the pyramid, banks, again, can't really handle the labor-intensive nature and the paper-intensive nature. But as you've heard from this panel, all of that is changing. So I do think that there is a coming together of microfinance from the bottom up and the banking system from the top down, that as we figure out how to harness this technology, we will come at this problem from both sides, and that's part of our vision of how we'll get to a financially inclusive world. The banks are very interested in this and obviously play a key role. The 2.5 billion people who live in poverty and lack access to financial services, we need everything. We need banks, we need insurance companies, we need the phone companies, we need, you know, and the microfinance industry to all come together to solve that issue.
Great. Thank you, Michael. One of our other questions, which I think is a very salient point, a lot of the focus of microfinance is on the developing world, and one question is, what can be done for the poor and the hungry and the low-income communities in the developed world and in the U.S. in particular? Some of the members of the CEO working group have exposure to programs here in the U.S.
Sure.
Alec, I'm pointing at Alex Counts.
Well, there was a time going back, I suppose, to the 80s where things were getting some traction in certain emerging markets and what we now call microcredit, microfinance. And one of the first to dive in, actually, to try this in an industrialized setting was actually in Brooklyn, I believe, Axione started, got it going, and others followed and tried to see if, you know, if you give a $50 loan in Bangladesh or India, and what's you do it through this way, what's the equivalent? Can it even work? And there have been kind of repeated attempts to kind of reinvent the model. There's a couple of pretty successful ones in Europe. But I'm at Grameen Foundation. We tried it in a small way in a couple of cities. Didn't really work out that well. And then I'm pleased to say that, again, I was probably one of the biggest skeptics, but some of my colleagues from Bangladesh came in and set up, basically took the Bangladesh model pretty much kind of lock, stock, and barrel, spent 6 months walking around Brooklyn and Queens to talk to people, getting a lot of doors slammed in their faces. Late 2008, early 2009, financial crisis is coming. They don't care. They're just talking to people. And in fact, this sister organization, Grameen America, has done extremely well and is now operating 21 branches in 11 cities around the country. The first branch, the original branch, is sustainable. There were people that, some of the best leaders in domestic microfinance for years said there's no way you can absolutely ever get a branch beyond 70% cost recovery. There are three more that are going to reach that within a year of Grameen America. So what we've seen, a little bit delayed, and it took a while to figure out the right format, but this continuous process of innovation, trial and error, tinkering is now, I think, catching up. In some of the, at least I think in the kind of densely populated urban areas of the industrialized world, we've kind of basically figured out how to make it work. It works, tends to work better among immigrant populations, long-term immigrant populations, and more recent immigrants. And so there's still gaps. But I think we've had a real breakthrough. And again, a lot of that breakthrough goes to some determined Bangladeshis who came in and started knocking on doors, but also there was a lot of spade work done by people back in the 90s and the 2000s that helped, I think, kind of get people thinking that this was possible, both policymakers, the banks that provide a lot of the financing, and even the potential clients themselves.
Thank you, Alex. Because we are in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley, there are a few questions about both the working group's position and whether there are any initiatives that concern looking at mobile money, transaction fees around mobile money, which many feel are still very high in the developing world, whether topics like peer-to-peer loans, global remittances, Bitcoin even come up in your conversations. And we'd love to hear a few comments on how some of the more sort of cutting-edge technologies play into some of the initiatives.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it. You know, I mentioned before some of the work that we've been doing in Africa in particular on structuring group savings products through mobile money platforms. That's been very interesting, very successful. You know, the core competency that Freedom from Hunger has historically is in the capacity development and financial education to groups and to agents, village agents. And so we've taken actually a huge amount of our core curriculum now and made it available in Latin America to the Spanish-speaking world through an e-learning course. It's also mobile-enabled. It's 120 hours to train field workers of microfinance organizations. Our view is that, you know, the private sector is going to sort out the competitive market for financial products. There's not going to be enough attention on the capacity of clients, on financial education of clients, and on the reality that if a poor person is really going to benefit from microfinance, it's essentially about the relationship that they develop with a field agent. That's the basic good that comes to a village, right? And so we see technology, both web-based and mobile, as a huge opportunity for educating field agents, for educating members of savings groups in particular. And we have a product now that in Latin America. It's 120 course hours. It's offered to train field agents of microfinance organizations. And we're developing a similar suite of educational products to promote the learning about the savings group work that we do in West Africa. Because, you know, responsible outreach and responsible kind of support to clients, really, we think is a critical kind of technology opportunity with what's happening, you know, with the digital revolution. So.
Thank you.
Can I just, I think, you know, we, Grameen Foundation, we set up a Grameen Technology Center in Seattle in 2001 with the support of some technology entrepreneurs there. And then we merged with a group called Digital Partners that was involved at the time with something called the Bridging the Digital Divide. So this is something we've been thinking about for quite a while. Muhammad Yunus had a real strong vision for this. BRAC, which is also represented here, has been a real technology innovator. I think if I had to sum it up once, for those of you here in Silicon Valley, in making technology work for the poor, the technology is usually the easy part. And actually the human element, and how do you rethink technology so that it's useful to a poor woman who's not mobile phone literate, who's not literate in her own language, and so forth. And it's also very country specific. One of the things that we've done just through our Bankers Without Borders program, which is a skills-based volunteer program with 18,000 people, including I think a handful of here who've come out from the Bay Area, is to actually take technologists and actually give them the exposure to what this really looks like in the field so that they can kind of come back and think about technology in a little bit in a way that through the eyes of a poor woman in India or Uganda. And we have a partnership with Google where we actually take a cohort of their employees every, I think it's every quarter or 6 months, and actually send them to one of our partners and field sites for not just, you know, a day or a drive-by visit, but something where they can really look at what's going on and with how they approach their own work and how they approach their work in financial inclusion, if they're involved in that, can be dramatically changed. Because again, it's the technology is not the hard part; it's the human element, and that takes real exposure and trying to again see the world through the eyes of a poor woman.
You touched on. Oh, sorry.
I just like to add
ahead,
a little
Steve.
Bit. You know, I want to get back to the point about health. I think. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to what's going to happen with healthcare globally, right? You know, the opportunities for financing very poor clients, for increasing access to health services are really, I think, going to be a major trend, right? And technology is going to be a big part of that. You know, we have a very interesting program in Latin America with telemedicine, for example. You know, mobile payment systems are a real possibility. You know, a lot of effort to benefit from not only behavior change communication in health and how that can be technology enabled, but, you know, certainly areas of education and training and supply chain. You know, these are all things that really are going to be big technology enablers for expanding access to healthcare to very poor clients.
Thank you. One of the other questions that we have, which in some respects builds on the topic we just discussed, is as microfinance organizations mature, grow bigger, how do you keep them innovative? How do you keep that innovative vein? Is that a role that the networks like Freedom from Hunger or Women's World Banking play? What are the key issues and challenges there, Mary Ellen? Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how do you keep these organizations innovative as they grow and microfinance mainstreams?
Well, I guess the leaders in our network are the ones that are constantly innovating, constantly reinventing. We have, I'd say, some of the strongest partners in our network. Just a historical fluke or three institutions in Colombia, for example. And they are each remarkable in their own way that once the cost of delivering a loan gets down to a certain point, they'll go back and reinvent that loan and try to get it even lower. I mean, they are really so committed to innovation in the service of their clients. I think one very interesting trend that I think many of us in the working group have seen is for those institutions, microfinance institutions that may have started life as NGOs and then made a strategic decision somewhere along the line to become regulated financial institutions, the way those deals are very often structured is that the legacy NGO sells its loan portfolio to the new financial institution and then becomes a substantial shareholder in that bank, but then is an NGO that probably isn't going to continue to do its lending business, and many of them are, you know, sort of casting around for what their next future role will be. And at least the ones in our network that have been the most successful are the ones that have provided those non-financial services that can support the work of the financial institution. So, for example, our partner in the Dominican Republic, Banco Autopem, extraordinary organization, but they came into being exactly the way I just described. Their NGO provides a tremendous amount of job training to women entrepreneurs, provides literacy, financial literacy. They now have a very successful, profitable first girls and now youth savings product, but that was really incubated in the legacy NGO. So I think the business model of the microfinance institution where you have the NGO supporting the for-profit institution is in itself an innovation and is a real way of keeping focused on mission while remaining profitable.
It also really highlights how important Alex's point was about focusing on social performance, right? And, you know, really getting organizations not just to focus on collecting loans or growing their portfolio, but really how they are contributing to making, you know, fundamental differences in their clients' lives. That's where innovation's going to come.
One of the things that's going to drive innovation is competition. Now poor women have a lot of choices, and poor men in the developing world, and that's a big force. But competition without standards can be kind of messy and really stifle innovation. In fact, in an earlier era where the kind of benchmark was, there was a certain benchmark for repayment rates, and we were once in a closed door meeting and said, well, how do you calculate repayment rate? And she said, I calculate it however I need to get to 98%. And so that's why I think it's unglamorous and perhaps unsexy, but this work of establishing standards for social performance, for client protection, for interest rate transparency, for reporting that the mix has been so important, and if you're familiar with that, this creates the level playing field where then true competition can emerge and both for investors, for donors, for volunteers, for clients. And with that, and with the diverse choice that people, a lot of people have now, that will. And then the last thing, though, I think is also going to drive innovation is fresh blood, fresh ideas. This is why we think it's so powerful, our Bankers Without Borders platform that I hope you'll all consider being part of, is, you know, most breakthrough ideas in any field of human endeavor come from people outside that field. And that's solely true. I think those of us who've been in microfinance for a long time, we're good at the incremental innovations, but the breakthrough ideas will come from the outside. So let's bring people from Silicon Valley in, and let's let you take a look under the hood about what we could do better. And that's, again, that's what we've designed a lot around that. And that's also why it's not been publicly announced, but our CEO working group has actually decided to add two members to bring some fresh blood and fresh ideas into what we're doing. And I don't know if I'm authorized to do this, but I'll also say that Lauren Hendricks from CARE and Shamaran Abed from BRAC are joining our deliberations in our group, and we'll be publicly announcing that. And we think that they're going to bring some innovative ideas into our discussions that'll proliferate because of the working group much faster than if we didn't exist.
Thank you very much. That brings up a good point for another question that came up from one of the audience members. And you've talked a little bit about the BWB program. You talked about sending folks from Google into the developing world context to work in microfinance institutions. What is a good way for a teenager or for youth to get involved in microfinance, and how, you know, are there other programs that can be mentioned here by any of you for, you know, more volunteer involvement, especially among teenagers and young people?
Well, I'll just tell one little story. I actually think that is, I went to a, we do a paper every 5 years surveying the literature about impact in microfinance. What do the researchers tell us? And the woman who wrote the last one was from a small Catholic university, Dominican University, in outside of Chicago. And the people in the university were so, undergraduates, so proud because they had, their Kiva group had outperformed any Kiva group in the university-based Kiva group except for one. I think it might have been Stanford or something. And but they were second, and that they were this small school. And so, it, again, the power of competition. But I think Kiva has done a tremendous job creating pathways for people at all parts of life, at all income levels, to feel like they're a part of this movement. And they've developed, got lots of ways for people to not just to loan through the Kiva platform, but to feel a part of it, to join peer groups and so forth. And so I think that's one obvious way people can engage. But hopefully it can grow, you know, grow more substantive as they gain more skills and more ability to contribute more. But
yeah, we've had a couple of schools go out sort of spring break to visit clients, and it's always, you know, just a tremendously powerful experience for the kids, for the teachers, and wonderfully for our partners as well, really to get a sense of learning from both sides of the table.
And, you know, our experience is a little bit more university-based. You know, we have a great relationship with the Blum Center for Emerging Economies. They're, you know, they're also based in Davis, where Freedom from Hunger is based. And, you know, that really provides a pool of, you know, 20, 25 students every year to do a whole variety of projects with us overseas. You know, Monterey Institute for International Studies is also a very big partner in that. So, you know, maybe some of the teenagers are going to have to pick the right colleges. I don't know, right? But there are some great programs around, and certainly look for that. You know, the Boulder Institute, too. You know, if people really want to become technicians in it, you know, explore those kinds of opportunities. But there's a lot happening to plug into, certainly.
Thank you. And as we heard earlier, too, there are local, you know, a growing number of local U.S.-based microfinance organizations that serve local communities. And it's about doing a little bit of research and seeing whether you can be of help getting in touch with the organizations. Poverty is a big problem. And so the more warriors we have to work against it, the better. We have time for just a couple more questions. Speaking about competition, there is a question about the informal economy. So microfinance is seen to have replaced payday lenders, things like chit funds in India, or not completely replaced them. But is there any evidence of how the informal money lender community is being impacted, or what impact do the traditionally informal sources of finance for communities have on how microfinance institutions operate?
Well, my network members say that their biggest competitors are not the banks. Their biggest competitors are the loan sharks. And it's they compete on price, they compete on service, they compete on, you know, that emergency loan when you just absolutely have to have that need. So there is still very much a players in this market. I think what we are starting to see in the research, though, is that there are some huge benefits that come along with just the process of formalizing, bringing people, particularly women, into the formal financial sector. That is the first step to so many other follow-on benefits. And we've recently, in the last couple of years, gotten involved with providing financial services to low-income factory workers, so not the traditional microfinance client. And we were seeing, even with people who had direct deposit of their salaries, so digital payment of their salaries, the women were going, you know, to the ATM, pulling all their money out, and then performing a whole array of financial services in the informal sector. The chit funds for their investments, the loan sharks for their loans, keeping money in the mattress. And so it's a huge opportunity for the microfinance institutions and banks to bank this community, particularly these people who have a regular income, regular money coming in. So I think for us, it's really a question of a market opportunity that is being left on the table. And if the informal financial sector providers are meeting that need, well, then shame on us.
Thank you. Perhaps a good question to end with: how small of a community is too small for microfinance to impact? So in the historical experience, and perhaps other members can contribute to this as well, can microfinance exist everywhere, or are there preconditions for success, especially size of a community?
We have a lot of experience, and this whole savings group movement in Africa has a lot of experience working in the most remote areas in, you know, communities that have probably the highest rate of malnutrition or deficits at certain seasons of the year. And, you know, self-help within those groups, the encouragement behavior of savings within those groups, you know, the lending to one another, very small scale. There's really compelling evidence. There was 7 RCTs that were done about the major actors in this group, you know, the CARE Access Africa program, Freedom Hunger, Oxfam's work. And the core conclusion was basically that income smoothing is the best way of ensuring that poor women have access to food year-round, right? And it has not displaced consumption in other times, right? That's very important, right? And so, yes, I mean, it can. And, you know, with mobile technologies, too, coming in, now the big challenge is, you know, how does it become replicable? How does it become scalable? And how does the cost of really servicing those kinds of clients come way down and it not be such charity dependent any longer? It actually be a viable strategy to pursue. That's a challenge they have. But yes, I think there are very isolated, very poor communities that can be reached now.
And I think, you know, technology and really building on these indigenous models, the village savings and loan associations, those are pushing the frontier of what is a non-viable versus a viable community to serve through microfinance in its many diverse forms. But I think, again, this iteration and constant tinkering of the model, we should be wary of writing any community or any person off. It's only if we can't reach them now, we just haven't been innovative enough in our models and our use of technology. In my mind, the job won't be done. And if, and, you know, leaders like John Hatch, the founder of Finca, Muhammad Yunus, the founders of Axione, the people that were doing this in the 60s and 70s, I think they all would be disappointed with us if we were to see that any person or any community was non-viable. If they're not, we just haven't done enough work in thinking and innovating yet.
Great. Thank you, Alex. I think those are great words to conclude our program for this evening. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council and the Microfinance CEO Working Group, I ask you to join me in thanking Alex Counts, Mary Ellen Eskandarian, Steve Hollingworth for this excellent discussion. And a big thank you to you, the audience, for your wonderful questions. And we'd like to invite everyone to join us for a reception, which will continue this conversation. But thank you very much for sharing the time with us. We really appreciate it. Thank you.